You wake up at 5:30 in the morning. You scarf down breakfast on the way to school. You do 30 minutes of mandatory military-style exercise. Then, at 7 o'clock sharp, the real work begins. Chinese class, then English, math, and so on. You sit still, respond when asked questions, and quietly, obediently memorize character after character, fact after fact. Officially, school ends at 5:15 p.m., but don't plan on relaxing just yet. After an hour for dinner, two if you're lucky, it's time for the next phase of your day, private tutoring. You sit in a room not unlike the one you just spent 10 hours in until 9, 10, or even 11 p.m. Then you fall asleep and do it all again. You do this because if you don't, you won't get tracked into one of your school's advanced classes, taught by one of its good teachers. If you aren't taught by a good teacher, you won't score well on the high school entrance exam. If you don't score well, you won't get placed into a good high school. If you don't get placed in a good school, you won't get a high score on the college entrance exam. If you don't get a high score on it, you won't get admitted to a good university. And if you don't get admitted, you'll never land a white-collar job. No job, no house, no house, no marriage. By the way, you're just 12 years old. This is childhood for millions of young Chinese. The only beneficiary of this soul-crushing existence are tutoring companies, the market for which quadrupled between 2012 and 18 alone, even as the number of students stayed roughly the same. At its peak, there were almost as many tutoring companies as schools in the country. Then, one Saturday evening in 2021, the government decided enough was enough. With the stroke of a pen, the entire $120 billion a year industry was decimated. Virtually overnight, 120,000 tutoring centers were ordered to permanently close, the effects of which rippled throughout not just the education landscape, but also the physical one. Malls, streets, and even neighborhoods were transformed, as if every McDonald's, Subway, and Starbucks suddenly disappeared. Thousands of private schools were forcibly sold to the state. Some homework was banned, and foreign nationals prohibited from working in the industry. One company laid off 60,000 people. So, what goal was so important that it compelled the government to destroy one of the largest employers of fresh college graduates at a time when youth unemployment was already soaring to record highs of over 20%? Partly, yes, ideology played a role. Gradually, the government had lost control of education. Just a few decades earlier, tutors were forbidden from operating as for-profit corporations. Now, they were listed on the New York Stock Exchange. Americans in Omaha were teaching kids in Fuzhou over the internet. And parents could effectively opt out of a Chinese education by sending their kids, say, to a British private school in Shanghai. Around the same time, the party went after tech companies, video games, and celebrities. Each crackdown shifted the balance of power away from private enterprises and toward the government. But this wasn't just about ideology, power, or national security. Beijing was also addressing a real social problem. Tutoring had become an arms race, and it was taking a toll. Weekends were for tutoring. Holidays for tutoring, and summers, you guessed it, more tutoring. It was also just really expensive. The average urban family spent 12% of its income on supplementary education, more than a rural family earns in total. In some parts of Shanghai, the average family spends $80,000, and that's before their child reaches high school. No wonder no one is having kids. Over the last 7 years, China's birth rate has plummeted from slightly higher than the United States to one of the lowest in the world. Lower even than Japan. Having endured this rat race themselves, would-be parents are reluctant to subject their children to the same, nor do they have the money. The industry was distorting the entire Chinese economy, draining it of money that could be productive elsewhere, acting effectively as a tax. In party speak, contributing to the disorderly expansion of capital. But far more dangerous than all of this was the effect private tutoring was having on perceptions of fairness. China, it bears remembering, is one of the most unequal countries on the planet. Between 1978 and 2015, the share of all income earned by the richest 10% rose from 27 to 41%, and the share earned by the bottom 50% fell from 27 to 15%. One group, about 600 million people, earns a mere $1,900 a year. They may grow their own food, do hard manual labor, and never leave their village or county. Their lives have more in common with someone living in Haiti or Nigeria than their fellow countrymen. Another group lives as or more comfortably than the average American. They own their own million-dollar home, travel the globe, and seamlessly commute across incredibly clean, modern, and crime-free cities. So, how does one country maintain social harmony between these two separate worlds? How can a Nigeria and an America coexist in such close proximity? In a word, meritocracy. Because the rich and poor alike believe that everyone gets more or less what they deserve. And the foundation of this belief is the Gaokao, China's college entrance exam. It absorbs all the anger that might otherwise be provoked by such vast disparities in wealth. Because Chinese employers care only about the college you attended and not the grades you got there, the Gaokao almost exclusively determines the country's economic winners and losers. And because it's a standardized, nationwide test that's nearly impossible to cheat on, all must be fair. Of course, all is not fair. Take Tsinghua University, China's MIT. More applicants are admitted from the city of Beijing, population 22 million, than the country's two most populous provinces combined, population 228 million. In one survey of 20,000 Chinese college students, just 42.21% were female minorities from poor rural areas. The really huge differences, however, are not between provinces, but within them. Yes, China's poorest provinces send a smaller share of students to elite schools than do its rich ones. But the best schools in its poor provinces send nearly all of their graduates to elite schools, whereas the worst schools in its richest provinces send none. Somewhere around 95 versus 2%, according to professor and anthropologist Zachary Howlett. Now, the party has gone to great lengths to conceal these numbers, maintaining the illusion of fairness, even while parents are vaguely aware of a few imperfections. But then, tutoring companies got greedy. What began, innocently enough, as a purely academic service, something they could pretend was aimed at helping those falling behind, slowly morphed into a highly sophisticated, unregulated, and commercialized product. The days of 17-year-olds teaching struggling 13-year-olds geometry at the kitchen table were over. Now, trained salespeople were persuading desperate parents to commit to expensive payment plans for proprietary test-taking confidence courses, taught by celebrity tutors for 300 students. Like any good business, they offered to sell what customers wanted to buy: exam shortcuts, strategies, tips, and tricks. And to effectively advertise their secrets to hack the Gaokao, they first had to convince parents that the Gaokao was a game that could be hacked. In doing so, they tarnished the sanctity of the exam, which came dangerously close to questioning the system as a whole. And as time went on, they became alarmingly good at exploiting parental anxiety, provoking guilt among those unwilling or unable to pay. This ad, for instance, reads, "Come and we'll train your child. Don't and we'll train your child's competitor." This aggressive marketing forced the government's hand. It had to crack down to restore faith in meritocracy. So, did it work? Not at all. Before the ink was dry, parents had already begun evading the rules. Some tutors secretly taught classes in hotels, libraries, or homes. Others renamed their English class to public speaking. And still others advertised themselves as professional nannies, housekeepers who just happened to hold advanced engineering degrees. Tutoring didn't stop, but it did become a whole lot more expensive. Previously, a single tutor might teach dozens or even hundreds of students at a time. Now, to fly under the radar, they often just teach one, forcing them to charge higher fees. Not only have low- and middle-income parents been priced out of the market, but they also lack the time to find, vet, and manage individual tutors. In other words, the crackdown had the opposite effect. None of this should be surprising. This is always what happens. Every single time. First, the public gets a dangerous peek behind the curtain, breaking the illusion of fairness. Maybe a tutoring company makes exaggerated claims about what you can accomplish for the right price. Maybe a famous actress buys her daughter's admission to USC. This, in turn, creates a tension. On one hand, the public outrage demands a response. Something must change. On the other, wealthy parents have enormous power and will never, ever, ever voluntarily surrender their children's advantages. Meanwhile, education reformers seize on this opportunity to advance their personal agenda, redirecting the public's outrage into support for their pet project – charter schools, Common Core, school vouchers, whatever. Caught in the middle are a few well-intentioned teachers, administrators, and admissions officers. This leads to an accidental, unholy alliance between those who wish to fix the system, the Trojan horse, and those who wish to exploit it, the smuggled goods inside. The result is a compromise, a way to kill two birds with one stone, to placate the angry public and appease wealthy parents at the same time. Policies that supposedly reduce inequality, yet in practice do the opposite, widen it. It happens in China, and it happens in the US. Americans are told horror stories about public schools. Reformers then channel this energy into support for charter schools, under the guise of giving poor and disadvantaged kids who are stuck in public schools a better alternative. The result, of course, is that wealthy kids flee to charter schools, leaving the rest in now underfunded public ones. Inequality disguised as equality. In the early 2000s, China attempted to create a more well-rounded, less high-pressure education that could accommodate many different types of children. Colleges began recognizing artistic, creative, and athletic talents, not only academic. So, naturally, wealthy parents signed their kids up for expensive violin and figure skating lessons, leaving no room for the gifted yet poor. Inequality disguised as equality. Likewise, US universities pride themselves on their holistic admissions, which look beyond the standardized tests that poor and disadvantaged groups struggle with, at other softer factors. Some schools even make the SAT optional. But all these policies do is shift the emphasis to letters of recommendation, extracurriculars, and personal statements, things the rich can more easily buy. Inequality disguised as equality. In fact, most ironic of all, it was precisely China's earlier attempts at reducing the burdens placed on children that led to the rapid rise in private tutoring in the first place. Parents figured that if schools weren't going to give their kids an advantage, they would simply buy it themselves. This was almost laughably transparent. Out of concern for the well-being of kids, the government would, say, order classes to end 2 hours earlier. Then, the best teachers would use that extra time to moonlight as private tutors, where they made far more money. In the process, 2 hours which were previously accessible to all became locked behind a paywall. Once again, say it with me, inequality disguised as equality. It's a tale as old as time. The only thing unique about this latest crackdown is its incredible speed and scale. In the past, reformers could always argue that implementation was incomplete, under-enforced, or uneven. In America, after all, there isn't really one education system, but 50. No reform is ever complete because there is no single reform. Similarly, in China, individual schools often simply disregard new national or provincial level initiatives. But not this time. Not when police patrolled cafes for signs of illicit algebra lessons. It's hard to imagine a more heavy-handed approach. Clearly, the problem was not a lack of enforcement. No, the reason this campaign failed is the same reason that all previous campaigns have failed. Only now it's clear to see. The Chinese government reduced the supply of tutors, the symptom, but it failed to address demand, the root cause. China's most powerful leader since Mao can successfully purge 2 million cadres for corruption, clip the wings of the country's richest men, and mobilize the world's largest army. The one thing he can't do is get between Chinese parents and their kids' education. As long as success is narrowly defined as getting a high score on the Gaokao, parents will do whatever it takes to help their children do so, legal or otherwise. No government, even one as forceful as China's, can persuade parents not to help their offspring. Again, this is not some new revelation. The entire history of education reform tells the same story. Across countries, cultures, and continents, education policy is nearly always guided by parents, not by government directives. So why do governments continually ignore this lesson? Because they're unable or unwilling to do the alternative. The simple, unfortunate reality is that everything favors the rich. There's no test, no process, no criteria or metric that doesn't give the wealthy an advantage. The most fair system is the age-old, simple, yet arbitrary standardized test. At least here, the rules of the game are known to all, even if everyone has a different starting place. Whereas, writing personal statements requires carefully navigating a minefield of magic words to say and not say. Recommendations, likewise, are about who you know. The Gaokao and the SAT are about the absolute best we can do. And they're still not very good. Perhaps education just isn't that good at reducing inequality, the wrong tool for the job. To produce outputs, grades, degrees, and all the things they lead to, schools rely, of course, on inputs. Individual students, their parents, resources, talents, and deficiencies. It stands to reason, then, that if we truly want to reduce inequality, we'd have to address those inputs. We'd have to look beyond education. And since there's no appetite for such sweeping social change, we're stuck spinning our wheels with wave after wave of misguided reforms. This is the real reason China banned private tutoring. It's a whole lot easier to blame schools than it is to confront China's 12-hour workdays, sky-high housing prices, and 20% youth unemployment. The intense competitive pressures which motivate students to try and get a leg up in the first place. To apply an ineffective band-aid, then address the underlying disease. China is often held up as an alternative, more efficient form of government. While America goes back and forth for years debating X, Y, or Z policy, never accomplishing anything, they argue, China just cuts through all the red tape and gets it done. But, as we've seen, it waited for the tutoring industry to quadruple in size before cracking down. And it went from zero regulation to near total regulation. Even then, it wasn't all that effective. The canonical example of this style of governance is the one-child policy. Nearly everyone remembers it as a tragic yet necessary sacrifice, an example of China's heartless yet astonishing effectiveness. Even as we question its methods, we envy its capacity. But the true story of the one-child policy is one of poor judgment, delayed action, and dubious results. Understanding it, in my opinion, is key to understanding how China works today. It's a critical lens through which so many things about the country suddenly make sense. And that's why I made this video, exclusively available on today's sponsor, Nebula, home to my now 7-part original series, China Actually. Nebula is the streaming platform built by and for creators. Unlike YouTube, Nebula is a platform we control. That means we're free to make the videos we want to make. And because you, the viewer, are the customer, not big corporate advertisers, we're incentivized to design the best possible viewing experience, rather than chasing short-term engagement. We can produce exposés, features, and in-depth investigations, not sensationalized tabloid news. We've got all kinds of exciting, high-budget originals coming later this year, including a feature-length documentary about baby boomers by Tom Nicholas, a reality travel game show by Wendover Productions called The Getaway, new episodes of Real Life Lore's Modern Conflict series, explaining recent wars we should know about but often don't, and much, much more. If you like videos like this one and aren't subscribed to Nebula, frankly, you're missing out on one of the coolest corners left on the internet. At a time when many services are raising prices and sneaking in more and more ads, over at Nebula, we just keep making great videos for the same low price. Normally, that price is $5 a month. But if you sign up using my link on screen right now, or in the description, you'll get it for just $2.50 a month. Alternatively, if you're not a fan of subscriptions or just want to support Nebula even more, you can get unlimited lifetime access for $300 today, using the Nebula Lifetime link in the description below.